This week, I am so happy to tell you that I got to talk with Aaron Crosby Eckstein about Junie, which will absolutely be in my top 10 of 2025. I loved this on audiobook. I loved the story. I loved getting to talk to her. But here is what it's about. 16 years old and enslaved since she was born, Junie has spent her life on Bellarine Plantation in Alabama, cooking and cleaning alongside her family and tending to the white master's daughter, Violet. Her daydreams are filled with poetry and faraway worlds, while she spends her nights secretly roaming through the forest, consumed with grief over the sudden death of her older sister, Minnie. When wealthy guests arrive from New Orleans, hinting at a marriage for Violet and upending Junie's life, she commits a desperate act, one that rouses Minnie's spirit from the grave, tethered to this world unless Junie can free her. She enlists the aid of Caleb, the guest's coachman, and their friendship soon becomes something more. Yet, as long-held truths begin to crumble, she realizes Bellarine is harboring dark and horrifying secrets that can no longer be ignored. With time ticking down, Junie begins to push against the harsh current that has controlled her entire life. As she grapples with an increasingly unfamiliar world in which she has little control, she is forced to ask herself, when we choose love and liberation, what must we leave behind? This book is fantastic on so many different levels. You know that I am a sucker for books that include books and the power of stories, and that is actually worked into this, even though you didn't hear about it in the synopsis. I think it's really important to be hearing these stories as our current administration is trying to kind of gloss over the part of history where America was only functioning because of enslaved labor. And I think it's really important to spend time, even fictionally, with a character to imagine how difficult it would be to live a human life with all of that going on. But something that Erin and I talk about is how she really wanted to make sure that Junie had her own humanity, and how would she be grappling with the world as an enslaved teenager. There's just so much about this book that I love. So I won't keep talking. Let's hear from Erin. So if you guys have been listening to me all this year, you've heard me talk about Junie by Aaron Crosby Eckstein, and I am so excited because I am going to talk with her about it now. So thank you so much for coming on, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I am too. So obviously I loved Junie, but I do typically want to kind of get to know a little bit about the authors before we dive into the book. So I kind of know the answer because I just reread your author note and acknowledgements, but what was your journey to writing? Like, how long have you wanted to write? And like, what was it like getting to Junie essentially?
Sure. So I don't know exactly when I started wanting to write. I wrote a lot of like books on printer paper as a child. Like, I was always sort of like stealing printer paper and like stapling it together at my grandparents' office and turning it into books. I think the first like major thing that I ever wrote that I felt a sense of confidence in was a short story I wrote for like an extra credit project in like the ninth grade. And I remember feeling like for the first time, I was always a really good student, but I was sort of the type of really good student that a little bit flew under the radar. Like, I was very quiet. It was the first time I felt like I did something where I felt like uniquely good at a thing. And that I really enjoyed this thing I'd done. But I ended up writing this one story. I kind of didn't write for a long time due to just being a high schooler. And then I got to college and I was often really just had a lot of anxiety and or insecurity about writing. I think I often thought that I just like couldn't possibly be good enough to actually write books. So I did everything sort of adjacent to that. So I was an English major and I studied books, and then I became a high school English teacher, which I loved. And I really just kind of devoted my life to studying books and spreading reading and really being involved in it. But one year way, way, way back in 2018, I was visiting my grandparents in Alabama, and my grandmother told me the story of my ancestor, who's my grandmother's grandmother's grandmother, we call my grandma Jane. And I'd heard the story before many times, but my grandmother just like happened to retell the story, and it's just stuck with me kind of differently on this particular telling. And in that sort of story of my ancestor who escaped from slavery. I ended up just kind of sitting with it and starting to connect it to other family stories I knew. I wanted to create this sort of intergenerational family novel, or I had this idea to. And I got started there initially. I ended up taking a writing class, which actually, full circle, I teach at the same place where I took my initial writing class now. And I initially started in this class with the author Rachel Lyon. Rachel was really, I think, very instrumental very early on in kind of pushing me along with doing the book and working on it. And I met some really incredible other writers in Brooklyn who I think we all became each other's sort of accountability buddies. And it just kind of moved along that way. I ended up writing the majority of Junie actually during COVID lockdown. Basically, I reached, due to a series of different factors, you know, I was a high school English teacher. So most of the time I just didn't have very much free time to be devoting to writing. But all of a sudden I couldn't leave my house. When it came time that I, you know, was teaching from home, I couldn't leave my house. It reached a certain point in lockdown as well, when most of my, I think all of my friends and family had left New York City, which is where I live. And so I was pretty much just me and my cat in my apartment. Yeah. And I ended up using that and like really devoting my time during that time to writing the book. And so that is really where that initially came together. And Junie was really, I think, came from a place of being inspired by a lot of different other novels and stories, but also wanting to weave in my own personal family history while also against the aforementioned cat. I wanted to weave in all of these different other books and authors that inspired me as, with my own family history to create something that, like, I just felt was a narrative I hadn't seen when it came to enslavement and American slavery before. So that was really my overall inspiration. And then, you know, books take a very, very long time. That's, I think, the thing readers often don't realize is that, you know, that book, when you go to the store and you're like, oh my gosh, the brand new book out. For us authors, we probably started writing that thing like at least five years ago. So it's, you know, I think there's a lot of secrets behind the scenes in some ways of like how long that process can really be. But that was sort of the journey to getting Junie to exist.
Yeah, especially I'm assuming because I read what your author's note in the acknowledgments. When you're trying to include like some of the essence that is your family. I also thought it was cool is hard to use it in terms of like enslaved people, but I appreciated how you said that like some of the depictions are either like paternalistic and angelic of like enslaved people, or it's like just trauma and like so heavy. And you mentioned how you wanted Junie to like feel like a true sense of humanity, actually all of the characters, but Junie specifically, where you like wanted it to be that she had these similar feelings and experiences and things that she was grappling with that like kind of all of us do as humans. So I'm assuming that like it sounds like you kind of really were thinking hard about how you wanted to tell the story and maybe like change some things a few times too.
I sat with that a lot as I was writing the story, because I had some awareness of the fact that I think there is a bit of sort of exhaustion out there, I think, with a lot of like Black trauma narratives, and that the books that are consistently published in fiction are often, and in beyond fiction, film, whatever, there's a lot of things that come out that are these sort of projects that center around these moments of like Black trauma. And there are a lot of people, I think, who really want to see more depictions of Black joy and more positive narratives. And a lot of people who I think like slavery narratives are just kind of laid out, which I disagree with, obviously. Right. But I do think that where I did come from, though, was that notion that you bring up from my author's note, which is that I often felt like when I'd read stories about slavery, you either have the book behind me over here, you got like the Gone with the Wind version, which is the Gone with the Wind version is like the slaves were just so happy to be there. They were just thrilled. It was a grand old time. They wish, frankly, once they got freed, they wish they could be slaves again. Like that's literally Gone with the Wind. And it's like obviously ridiculous and beyond not true. And like deeply offensive. While though that said, on the flip side, I do often think that we also can often see depictions of enslavement, which I think are far more accurate, where they are very, very focused on just the physical horrors of slavery. And I do think that like when it comes to those narratives, those are necessary mm-hmm. and important. But at the same time, I have often felt reading those that I wanted to know more about the characters' inner yeah. lives. There are a few things that really led me to that. One thing was what my writing teacher way back, Rachel Lyon, said in one of our classes, where she said something about how, and I'm going to misquote her a little bit, but that every character you write should have dreams. Mm-hmm. Every character needs to have dreams. Regardless of their situation, you need to write characters who have some sort of a dream. And I really felt that to be a necessary point. And it really intrigued me to write a character who is in a situation that most people would think is going to squash any hope of a dream yes. possible, but to still see a lot of the human need and ability to dream under, in, you know, horrible circumstances. Yeah. I also really felt strongly as well about wanting to depict like a teenager. Yeah. I wanted Junie to really reflect like an adolescent mindset because a lot of the way I kind of go about it, thinking about it, is there are expectations, societal expectations of teenagers have changed.
Right.
Brain science of a teenager has not changed. Like teenagers' brains have not changed since 1860.
Right.
So I, you know, as a high school English teacher, I really felt like I wanted Junie to reflect what I knew to be adolescent brain yeah. development. And I wanted her character to reflect that under her circumstances. And I wanted her to, as a result, therefore be flawed, complicated, making mistakes. I wanted it to be clear that these are people who lived their entire lives under this particular right. system, that this wasn't just something that they stumbled into and it was new to them one day. This was, you know, by the time you're getting to Junie, she's living right before the Civil War. Mm-hmm. She is at the, you know, the end of the 250 yeah. plus year history of American slavery.
But she's not aware of it. Like we are as we read it.
And she's yeah. not. We mm-hmm. know that, but she doesn't even know that. Like she's the tail end of this. She has not, there's not a soul that she knows or could have possibly mm-hmm. known who was not going to have been a part of the system right. in some way. So that is really a lot of what I also wanted to mm-hmm. depict, was very much almost like a kind of what I thought of as almost like a Plato's mm-hmm. cave kind of vibe of like, if you think about the Plato's cave allegory, it's like the person who's in the cave doesn't know there's anything but the cave. They're just living their life in the cave.
Yeah.
Like that's it. And so I wanted Junie in some ways to reflect that even under these horrifying conditions, there are still aspects of the human condition that persevere regardless, that we know to be mm-hmm. the case, that people still continue to fall in love. They still continue to like be annoyed with their yes. parents. They still continue to like, want to rebel or find yeah. ways to find excitement. You know, these are all things that are just true about yeah. people. And for me, I didn't do that out of a desire to soften mm-hmm. any of it. It was really because I wanted, actually, in a lot of ways, I felt like leaning more into the full humanity of the characters actually amplified how awful the circumstances right. were, because I wanted everyone to be able to read the book and say, wow, like this character reminds me of a real person yes. I know, or I wanted this character to feel like someone that people could imagine and connect with, which would therefore make reckoning with, oh my God, people used to just real, full, complex human beings used to exist under yes. this system. And, yeah. you know, many who continue to exist under similar systems even to mm-hmm. today. So that was really my thought mm-hmm. process in wanting to create this book, was really wanting to craft these like very well-rounded, flawed characters that felt fully
yes.
human.
Yes, they really do. If you're an author who's listening right now, I'm sure that sometime recently you thought to yourself, I really just want to write and I don't want to have to think about social media. The good news is I have a couple solutions for you. If you just need help brainstorming ideas and building out posts in Canva, my monthly consulting might be good for you. If you're about to publish a book, I can help you with a book trailer. The other option is accumulating a content bank of both long and short form content that can be used now and generically into the future. I love reading your books and I know you don't love figuring out how to post on social media, so I would love to help. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more. And I think at least for me, because you're just so attached to her and other characters as well, but especially her, mm-hmm. it almost added to the suspense, which this may fit with the Southern Gothic vibes, mm-hmm. is there was so much, the suspense for me was in like the fear that I knew that like at any point, like the McQueens could have just like killed her, like whatever. There was like this suspense, yep. where it's like, oh, like I'm pulling for her, but I know the circumstances. And so then you're like scared just because of that part. But you are so connected to her as a human. And you're like, no, we can't let that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the circumstances themselves, and it may produce like dramatic irony, is the English teacher term for it, where you, the reader, know something that the character doesn't. So you, the reader, you know, we, the readers, are sitting there knowing, we know what happened during, you know, American slavery. We know these like wide, we have this wide context on these different experiences, all these different things. Obviously, Junie doesn't. Junie only knows her own set of experiences. So there is an additional 100%, like an additional tension. And I think fear that just comes in with just knowing how that entire time period went and us having a knowledge that she doesn't have. Because it's funny, I get a lot of reader comments that are like, why is Junie so stupid? Like, why is Junie like so reckless? Like, why is this character she's making me mad? She's like, and people have, it's funny. And I like, I totally get it that like Junie's meant to be a kind of frustrating character. Like, I wrote her to be frustrating under the circumstances, but I think that frustration for readers often comes from the fact that, one, she is a teenager, and teenagers are just deeply frustrating. Like, as a person who spent I was a high school English teacher for many years. Teenagers are deeply frustrating. Like, I loved being a high school English teacher, but like part of working with teenagers is being aware of the fact that like they don't make good life choices.
They're not ready
like, they don't do it. Like, I, you know, I, regardless of the day, I was like, there was going to be some kid who like threw a jug of milk down the hallway and filmed it for TikTok. Yeah. Like, or like we had kids who would be like, I think it's a good idea to like throw plates on the freeway. Like anything could be happening because they're teenagers and teenagers are just,
even the hormonal transition. So, like they don't even feel like themselves. They don't know what themselves means really.
They don't know what it means. Like, they're getting into fights in the hallway. Like, they're doing anything, you know, and that is so much of what I wanted to feel in Junie, that everybody, you know, I think a lot of us can read it and be like, girl, the thing you're doing is clearly unsafe and stupid. But it's like, yeah, but 16-year-olds do stuff that's clearly unsafe and stupid. And then on top of it, similarly, I think a lot of our own anxiety for her about being like, girl, you're being really, really unsafe under your circumstances is, again, we know about these circumstances in a way that she doesn't. She only knows as much as is available to her on Belrhaine and as much as her family is going to tell her. And again, if you're thinking about a teenager, I don't know about you, but personally, when I was a teenager, if my parents came up and told me, hey, don't go do that thing, there was a pretty decent chance I was going to spend a lot of time thinking about going and doing that thing. Like, that's you usually, you know, teenagers are trying to touch the stove, as I put it. Like, that's, you could tell them that the stove is hot, but they sure will be touching the stove because they want to, they have, that's part of, unfortunately, that's kind of part of human development is people, teenagers do crazy risk-taking behavior because
you don't know yet that life's actually scary. You kind of don't know. You don't
know.
Agree with your own mortality. Like, you don't think you're really going to die. Like,
exactly. Yeah. You don't really think that's going to happen to you. You don't really think that your body's going to like change in some meaningful way. You hear these things, but you don't really think they could actually happen to you as a teenager. And, you know, that's why we see teenagers, you know, do all kinds of stuff. Like, and that's how teenagers have been, you know, for time immemorium. Yeah. And we see it in all kinds of, you know, funny ways in history. People, you know, there's all kinds of like revered authors or, you know, figures and people like that who did stuff when they were really young. We're like, wow. The one that comes to mind right now is Mary Shelley off the top of my head. We're like, because I just watched Frankenstein last week and I love Mary Shelley.
Were you able to see it in theater?
Mary Shelley. I saw it in the theater. I'm so glad I got to see it in theater. But she, you know, I think about Mary Shelley as a great example that like we think of her as this like revered author, but she wrote Frankenstein when she's 19. So like, she started Frankenstein at 19, and which means that all of the stuff that happened in her life prior to Frankenstein, she was like a full-blown teenager. So if you think about the fact that she like ran off with a way older man that was clearly not a good person for her to go running off with. Who, like, she was doing crazy stuff. You read her biography and you're like, why was this author so insane? And then you're like, oh, right. She was like 16 doing running off with Percy Shelley, or like disappearing with, like, where, you know, running off to Italy with a bunch of, you know, poets to go sit in a castle somewhere with a bunch of dudes who are clearly not way older than her and, like, clearly weird. You know, bad vibes. Also with her, like, stepsister, she's wild.
I know, you're Mary Shelley, now again, I need to read her biography.
I went to the Mary Shelley Museum when I was in England years ago, like, a while back. There's like a Mary, and I learned so many things. Gosh. That woman, like, I was like, I learned so many things about this human being. It's wild.
She was and it makes sense how she could write that at 19 is like something that, like, that book is so, and there's so many quotes from it, so aware of, like, men without empathy and tons of power is a problem. So, like, no wonder she knew that by 19 is what I'm realizing.
Exactly. She was surrounded, you know, she had, like, her father who was, because her mother died giving birth. Her mother was, like, a famous feminist, and her mother died in childbirth. Like, her mother's this, like, Mary Wollstonecraft, who's, like, this very, very prominent famous, like, old school, like, 18th century feminist. And, you know, so she was, like, raised by all these, like, very domineering men, and then, like, ended up in a relationship with, like, a way older dude who was, like, also hooking up with her sister. Oh. It was a mess. Like, it was bad. And then there's, like, Lord Byron. Like, it was crazy. So you see it all, though. All this to say, I think that if we often, I think people look back on the past and imagine that people had, were all, you know, these old, refined people who had figured out their stuff, and that it was, I was like, the past is so messy. And humans have always been messy. And teenagers in particular have always been messy. And we have to, I think it's super important to, like, remember and acknowledge that as we look back at all kinds of different historical contexts, including, you know, ones that seem harrowing and insane, and ones where you would think that the people would learn to have caution, but we know people don't.
No. Well, and like, her being a teenager, and your point about Plato's cave, like, not in much less harsh conditions, I, like, very much understand what it's like that in your childhood you do not know what you don't know. So it's even just, like, she's only grown up there. She's around it, but, like, again, even if you're 16, you might still think, like, this life is kind of good. Like, there are good parts of it, and and there are good parts to her life, which is, like, that other, like, endearing part, I guess, maybe, or the part of the story where it's not just horror and it's not just the trauma that enslaved people were living through then. It's like, she does, like, love being outside. She does love reading, which I thought was such a cool, and if you think this is a spoiler, I can move it, but you talk about your choice to make her literate somewhat just because of, like, a way to connect to, you said how, like, your family has always loved stories and reading. So I thought that was really cool too. But also, it, like, gives her a framework to try to understand her life, is how I felt when I was reading it. That it's like helping her know, like, oh, this is what you can hope for in life, or this is what's hard about life. So can you kind of talk about, like, there are so many books referenced. I have, like, Cinderella, Snow White, Keats, Wordsworth. We've got, like, so many things. We can feel your English teacher in there. Can you talk about wanting to include those books?
Sure. I think partially it was just for fun, like, my own inspiration in it. But a lot of it as well was I felt like books were a really good anchor in a relationship, her relationship with Violet, and to better understand their relationship, as well as, again, it does give Junie, I think, a really important framework that allows her to start seeing things differently than she might have otherwise. I think it's very obvious why they did not want enslaved people to know how to read, because if they could read, they immediately started quickly figuring out that things were not right.
They could communicate with each other better.
Pretty obvious. Exactly. But I think one thing I often thought about with Violet is that I think the reading becomes an interesting point in their relationship, because I think Junie initially, I think Junie often interprets the fact that Violet taught her how to read as, like, a pause, like, this kind of sign of like love, friendship in some ways, right? Like it's a bit of their connecting point and it feels like this connection of the relationship. But often what I try to emphasize is that like Violet doesn't teach Junie how to read out of like a sense of benevolence. Like it's not really that Violet is like, I think it's wrong that you can't read and I'm going to teach you because I think it's wrong. Violet teaches her how to read because Violet's basically like, you are my live-in playmate. Like you are my, you are essentially like an animate doll for me in some ways. And Violet loves to read. So if she's essentially doing like build a best friend, she's like, my best friend needs to also know how to read. And so that was really often what I kind of thought about in the context of what was going on. That Junie also, again, only is limited, of course, by whatever Violet's going to pick out. It's not like Junie gets to have wide access to whatever she wants to go read. It's going to be whatever's available to her. And so that was some of what I also was really reflecting on with the reading. And it gave me an opportunity to just, again, want to be sort of intertextual and thinking about like, how did Junie's story reflect these other ones? I thought that, I don't really know when in my process I started thinking so much about like the sublime. I think I really liked all of those romantic poets when I was around that age. Like, I think I kind of got into that whole thing when I was like 16 and I thought again, it was really this interesting contrast again to, I wanted to put it in like the most extreme terms possible of this sort of someone desiring this sort of like limitless freedom concept that the sublime is, but you put it into someone who seems to be like the absolutely most disempowered person you can think of. And in many ways, again, I really, which I wanted to also think about this in the context of, again, like the guys who, you know, all the people, these romantic poets who I was, you know, the Lord Byrons, the Percy Shelleys, all of these guys who were writing about that, there, these are all like affluent white men. Like all of these men were, you know, these were all men who had money, who had the ability to travel, who could essentially like, you know, go off and be like, I'm gonna go sit on a hill and think about how the city sucks and I am pursuing, you know, the ultimate sublime out here in nature. Yeah, it like, it's doable for them because they were these affluent white men. And you know, and I think that was some of what I also wanted to explore with Junie as it goes on. But yeah, I think a lot of the books were really me sort of sitting with, and I think it also just became fun for me at a certain point too, to like think about the time period and like try to imagine what would Violet have on this bookshelf and like think about what would be the books that would make sense for her to have had. I did a lot of thinking too, where I tried to not have any books that would have come out like within 10 years of the start of the book. Because I was trying to be relatively like, okay, it wasn't like easy to get books. It wasn't the same way it is for us. So I tried to be like careful and be like, okay, well, I'm not going to try to pick something like, it's 1860. I'm not going to pick something that came out in like 1858 because like, would, if, you know, I was like, I don't know actually how she might've acquired that. And so I'm going to like stick with stuff that's like older and would have given her time to somehow come across it. And so, yeah, I found it to be just like, part of it was just like, it was fun. But also those were some of my thought processes as we went through it.
Yeah. The, what you were saying in the beginning about Violet, that was the part that like the whole time when you're, well, you said she's got to like build a friend essentially is what she's doing. And I had a quote highlighted where basically she says, where was it? Oh, I completely lost the quote, but she basically says, oh, I had it pulled up. That's okay. It went away. But yeah, like even Violet kind of says something to her. She's like, well, you have to, like you have to, because I said so. And I was like, ugh. And it, Caleb is like a friend and kind of a, I don't know if that's in the synopsis, but kind of a love interest. Basically, Junie's intrigued by Caleb, who comes to the plantation at one point. And he kind of feels like he was like the one that was challenging her naivete a little bit, to where he's like, she kind of thinks she's in a loving friendship with Violet, and then the whole time I at least am just like, when is Violet gonna be terrible to her? Like I mentioned earlier, and he mentions like, there's, he says something along the lines to her of like, ain't no love if you gotta own the person to be friends with them first. And I was like, well, that is a lot to grapple with. And to your point of like her being a teenager too, like she wants to believe that she could be friends with Violet. And that maybe she did teach her benevolently, which we're not mm-hmm. thinking that necessarily as we're reading it either. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was just such a complicated relationship where she just wants the convenience of like a forced book club to make it even more like she's yeah. like, I want to talk to someone about these books. So you learn how to exactly. read too.
So like, yeah, you're going to yeah. read too, and we're going to read together. And like Violet in her own way doesn't really, you know, she's fine with, Violet doesn't particularly like her parents' rules right. anyway. So Violet's fine with teaching them because she's like, I don't care what my mom has to yeah. say about it. I'm going to teach you anyway. But it's, you know, again, it's out of Violet's own desire. And I do think that Caleb is meant to come mm-hmm. into the story very much as someone who has seen way more of mm-hmm. the world than Junie has, even though Caleb has only seen as much as he's seen. He's still seen a lot more mm-hmm. than Junie has. And I think that he's meant to be sort of an interjection of a type of person that Junie has just never met, experienced, heard from, any of that. And he's supposed to come in and very much be like, hey, maybe think about this thing yeah. differently, or maybe see this thing differently yeah. In a way that's meant to sort of, you know, shake up her mm-hmm. life a bit.
And she does, when you were talking about like the romantic poets, like she connects to that. And that's probably because of even like her age, but it could also be like personality. But it's like, for her, it's mm-hmm. never gonna be practical to be as romantic as they are about things. And like you're saying, like I had pulled that quote too, where like the like Keats and Wordsworth saw it an unattainable beauty because they already had it all. So it's like, of course mm-hmm. they're able to just like daydream about kind of like utopia or the sublime, like all of that. Mm-hmm. And it ends up not being something that works for her, but also consuming it still, what I think is kind of cool there is it still helps her start to understand the world a little bit more, even when she's getting to the mm-hmm. point of like, oh, this is not how I can live my life and like think about things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it definitely is meant to spark like something mm-hmm. in her, but initially she doesn't really know what yeah. that thing is yeah. quite. Like she's like, she knows she kind of wants something that feels freer mm-hmm. or she's like pursuing something, but she doesn't really know what it is. She doesn't really know how to lock mm-hmm. onto it. She's not there yet as the story of right. course progresses.
Yeah.
And she needs sort of the kick of people, of like mm-hmm. Minnie, of you know, Caleb, of all these different things to start to open her yeah. eyes far yeah. more to her reality.
So I heard you on the Book Gang podcast. I'm friends with Amy, who does that. Mm-hmm. And you were explaining Southern Gothic, which is actually something sometimes people do ask me. They're like, what do you mean when you're saying that about a story? Because I got really into mm-hmm. it, probably more like contemporary modern Southern Gothic at first. And now mm-hmm. I just enjoy it in general. So can you kind of talk about like what Southern Gothic, I mean, you're an English teacher, so you would know what Southern Gothic is, kind of how Gothic fits with the Southern Gothic, and then like the choice to kind of include like Minnie and her sister's like ghost elements in your story.
Sure. So Gothic has like a long history. If you're going back initially, very kind of like early Gothic stuff is going to be like 18th century. And it used to be that at its root, like originally Gothic is always going to take place like kind of traditional, like British-y European mm-hmm. Gothic. You've got like crumbling castles, like there's mystery, there's melodrama. There's often used to be in very old school Gothic, there's usually going to be some sort of like damsel in distress situation mm-hmm. with some sort of like creepy dude who might be like trying to cause problems for yes. her. But there's always a real emphasis on sort of like gloom and darkness and death and decay. These sort of kind of that, those sort of darker underbelly themes. And that's really when you're looking at like early initial Gothic novels, they're usually going to be like, you're in a crumbling abbey yes. somewhere and maybe it's haunted and blah, blah, blah. And that changes over the course of the 19th century as Gothic sort of develops much more with things like Frankenstein's a great yeah. example. Frankenstein is totally a Gothic novel, but she does something really different with it by making it into what is now known as the first science fiction yes. of taking these, you know, themes of death, decay, whatever, you know, on putting in all these crumbling places, but she morphs it to dig into more of like human condition, the limits of humanity, what is moral, you know, what's ethical, all mm-hmm. these different things. And there's so many who build upon it, who kind of move it away from being all about just like weird guy chases girl around castle to being much more like, you know, Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, even things that they start doing, you know, Charles Dickens does like Bleak House that's set in a city. Mm-hmm. There's just so many different examples. Pretty much like every one of those sort of like classic old school horror stories that people think, you know, the Draculas, the whatever, like all Jekyll and Hyde, all of that is going to fall under some level of gothic because they're all these kind of like dark, you know, dark historical, you know, dark settings that are going to feel gloomy, creepy, mystery oriented, suspense oriented. Melodrama is very important as well. All of these kind of features are going to be there. And then Southern Gothic is different because Southern Gothic moves us from the sort of European context into an American context. And of course, in America, we don't have, you know, crumbling medieval castles because we don't have that here. What we had in place of that is we get into the, like, I think Southern Gothic really is like a 20th century situation. What we had as crumbling buildings were crumbling old plantations. So Southern Gothic really develops out of the context of the crumbling American South and really this like taking the sort of themes and vibe of the of Gothic, the kind of like traditional British Gothic, and moving it into plantations, swamps, like moss everywhere, ghost stuff, but it's all much more about the haunting of, in many ways, like slavery itself and the social historical context of all of that. It's like that haunting. So you have a lot of Southern Gothic is really going to be that sort of like swampy plantation-y kind of horror, and it's just transplanting the setting. It's keeping the themes the same, but it's moving it into this setting. And it's interesting too because now we're starting to, like, I feel like I've seen a lot more Gothic popping up that's like almost like Latin American Gothic is becoming much more of its own thing recently. Like Mexican Gothic is a great example by Silvia Moreno Garcia. Like the Hacienda is another really great example. There are more that I'm not thinking of right now. There's so many that have been popping up. I feel like
there's one called Salt Bones that I just read that was really good.
There's like a bunch, which is interesting because I think a lot of those are taking what is the Hacienda system and they're sort of setting them all within the Hacienda system, which the Hacienda system is very similar to like the American plantation system. So you see a lot of, again, this sort of new world Latin American takes on it where you're getting the same exact sort of like creepy, haunty feels, but they're putting it within, again, this colonial context there. And in a lot of cases, I think Gothic is ultimately supposed to really get back to like the horrors of people. And I think like the best Gothic novels are usually the ones that aren't scary because of the, like, they don't, like, Gothic, you don't have to have supernatural. You don't need the supernatural. Like, a lot of them have it, but you don't need it. But what it comes down to is, like, ultimately it should circle back to the idea of that, like, the real horror is, like, other people, usually. I often think about, like, Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro is, like, a really great example film-wise of a lot of that, of, like, it's creepy, it's totally gothic and weird, and, like, but ultimately the point of that movie isn't, like, that the weird stuff is scary. It's like the other people are the problem. Like, it's like the other people are what is scary, and like are the real evil. And I think a lot of Gothic ultimately circles around that. So for me, with including Minnie is certainly definitely like a ghost. We're definitely working in Gothic land, particularly if you have like a rueful, angry ghost. I think a lot like something like Toni Morrison's Beloved also, which, like, fun fact, a lot of people often think that like my book was directly inspired by Beloved. I'm currently reading Beloved for the first time. I've never read it before. I completely offhandedly by chance happened to have overlaps with that book. It's really wild. But I'm reading it for the, I've read other Toni Morrison, but like weirdly had not read Beloved. And so I'm reading for the first time now. But again, that sort of like vengeful ghost concept is very much entrenched in a Gothic idea. And that's why I wanted Minnie to sort of fit into that like this plantation is very much haunted, but it's not haunted in the way of, you know, it's not haunted housey haunted. It's not haunted as in there's stuff that's jumping out at you trying to scare you. It's haunted in the sense that there have just been horrific things that have happened there. And that Junie has this connection to really a ghost that in some ways is one that she wants to see, but is also a complicated ghost for her in many ways, and a ghost that is vengeful ultimately, and is also trying to motivate her towards things that Junie doesn't necessarily want to do. I kind of like, I did not think of this at the time that I was writing it, I realized it after the fact.
Because it kind of introduces the mystery element that, that Minnie does. Yeah. She's kind of like, figure this out.
And I didn't really think of this until after Britannic, but like Minnie almost functions kind of in a similar way to the ghost in Hamlet. Oh, yeah. Is like, if you think about, I will say right, that was not planned. I did not realize that when I wrote the book. But in what I think comes through with her is this idea that like she shows up basically and is like, hello, I'm presenting you with stuff you need to figure out now. See ya. In some ways, in the same way that like Claudius's ghost rolls up on Hamlet and is like, hey, or sorry, no, Hamlet's dad's ghost rolls up and is like, hey, Claudius killed me. You need to go do revenge. Figure it out. Bye. And, you know, and then Hamlet spends the entire play being like, should I? And being like, what happened to me? Was that ghost real? What's going on? Yeah. And so I think Minnie, in some ways, I think functions to some extent in a, not as directly, but like in a sort of similar way. She introduces a lot of the mystery and the tension that wouldn't otherwise be there. And focuses on, you know, moving Junie forward and getting Junie to like be pushed along her path and her journey in a big way. And I just like, I love ghost stories. I love a good ghost. I just think ghosts are great. I love the concept. I love, you know, I like finding out about ghost stuff in real life. Love some ghosts in literature. Like ghosts are just fun.
Yes. So my friend Steph coined the phrase recently where she was like, I really do love stories where the dead or undead are along for the ride. And I'm like, I love thinking of it that way.
They're just here to hang. And I think it can be really fun to like work that into it and to just have that narrative in it. And that was why I think I was pretty inspired right before I started working on it. I was quite inspired by Isabel Allende's House of the Spirits, which is like just a book I absolutely love. And that's another one where it's magical realism. Mm-hmm. So it is, again, like otherwise pretty like historical standard setting that just like has some ghost.
Yeah.
Like sometimes there are ghosts there. And I think that was very much kind of what I wanted to convey in Junie, was that it's a pretty otherwise not supernaturally book. It's just this one interjection of a ghost that appears that I wanted the book to have that magical realist quality of, we're not in like a full fantasy world, but we do suddenly have there sort of like a thinning of the veil going on.
Can I ask you a really huge favor? One of the biggest indicators in audience growth and podcast popularity is ratings and reviews. I am always going to be growing Book Wild and the range of guests that we're able to have, but the one thing that you can really do that would help grow Book Wild is rate and review on whichever platform you listen to. And if you do rate and review, send me a screenshot because I would love to send you some Book Wild bookmarks. Now let's get back to the episode. I have a note here. I can't remember if it literally starts in the river, but it kind of does and ends in the river. Was there any like, did you kind of want to bookend it that way, or is it just it happened that way?
It kind of happened that way. I think the book, the beginning of the book, I weirdly has like not ever really changed. Like that's one of the things about the book that I think stayed the most consistent across drafts. And she kind of just doing the same thing at the beginning every time. And then I think if we're getting into spoilers,
for spoiler alert
ending. For spoiler alerts on the ending. Yeah. I did want her, it felt right to like have her end there as well. Like I wanted it to have that sort of circular moment for her in some ways of like, we don't start in the same place, but we start with hearkening back to things that happened in the beginning, or we end with things that happened in the beginning. And honestly, like that was the truth of what actually happened to my ancestor. Mm-hmm. So that was some of what I also wanted to convey there. Like my real, and it's so funny because for years when people would ask me what my book is about, and I was like, oh, it's based on this ancestor of mine, but I can't really tell you what happened to the ancestor because it's a spoiler for the book. Like I was like, I can't really tell you what happened because that's kind of the whole thing. But you know, my real ancestor, she escaped from a plantation and somehow got across this river and made it to the area that my family now lives in. You know, she like went through this absolutely harrowing escape and crossed a river, like upstream, and somehow made it there. And we've still really like don't 100% know how. Like, I don't really know how she pulled that off. It's, you know, it's not like a crazy far distance to us now, but of course, in like 1861, when you're enslaved and running away, like, I really don't know how that happened. So a lot of, you know, Junie's escape at the end is partially me, you know, knowing some details, but essentially like concocting a lot of it because I was like, I don't really know how this woman pulled this off. But she did somehow. And at the end of the book, you know, I wanted the place where the book ends is like a real place. That island where she like lands is a real island. That's just off of the town, like legitimately just off of the town where my family's from. So she, I like had her, like the Three Rivers meeting thing is a real place. And so I knew I wanted to bring her to this particular location and I wanted her to end up there just because I knew where that was on the map. And I have such like an awareness of it from my own family history and just like being in this town all my life. And so I knew that's where I wanted her to end up. And I think the other big thing for me in the ending is I always, always, always knew that Junie was going to have to end the book by herself. Like she was always going to have to end up alone. That was always going to be critical to me about this, which makes a lot of people sad, but is unfortunately like what happened to the real person? Right. And I, you know, I felt it like deeply, deeply necessary to honor my ancestors' real experience there by having that be the case. Because my real ancestor, the story varies. Like I've heard it both ways, but like either she was pregnant when she ran away or she had like an in-arm baby. It was like one or the other. Like it's either way. It's insane.
It's either in her stomach or she's holding it.
Or she was holding it. It was like one or the other. And then her husband was like killed during the escape. Like they go to escape together and he was killed. And you know, in my original ending, that is what happened to Caleb, but I got so many protests from my agent and like other people that they were like, you literally have to change this. And so then we had to settle on the like ambiguous ending that it now has. We settled on the ambiguity ending. But that was, I mean, my real ancestor, she genuinely like ran away.
Yeah. And like is a big part of the town, or was a big part of developing it, or being there.
She lived to be like well over 100. She only died because she got hit by a horse and buggy.
To have lived that life, and then that's what happens.
Yeah, she was bringing a cake across the street. Apparently, she was like walking a cake across the street and got hit by a horse and buggy and died. God. And we were like, it's insane to me. Every time I'm like, the fact that this woman somehow that was what ended up for her. And you know, and it's cool in a lot of ways that I have even this information about her. It's rare for, I think, a lot of people, you know, black people who are descendant from slavery in that way to have these types of like immediate accounts of their ancestors. But because she lived such a long time, her story stayed alive, and she ended up raising, I think it's like it's interesting in my family because there's like a chain of grandmothers that basically have kept it alive, where Grandma Jane raised my grandmother's grandmother. So basically, if you're doing the chain, like she raised my grandmother's grandmother, and then my grandmother's grandmother raised my grandmother. So it was like this, like, and then my grandmother very heavily like raised me in many ways, and so it was this sort of chain of ancestors who kept this particular narrative alive because there was such, it was just passed down. And so, you know, it's cool in many ways that I have this ancestor who I, of course, like could not have never have possibly known, but who I do have enough details on to be able to like write this book and think about. And, you know, it a lot of it too, as I got older, it just sat with me how unbelievably harrowing and risky her choice was, you know, once you really know the context of how escapes went most of the time. Thinking that, and I also came to, you know, there's a lot of context around where she ended up in the town where we live in. The place that she ran away to is an area that ended up being like much more open to Black land ownership in the South, which really surprises people. So she ran away from a county. The county that she was enslaved in is the county that to this day is like one of the most impoverished counties in the United States. Like it is a level of like I think the UN went in there years ago and said that like the levels of poverty are like on par with some of the worst they've ever seen. Like it is like a deeply, deeply impoverished county because it was it historically after slavery ended, it became like a sharecropping county. And it's just then pretty much just got abandoned and like there was no economic development. It just it you know, a horrible systemic racism happened and it has become what it is. But on the flip side, the county that my my ancestor ran away to ended up becoming a place that was open, more open to Black land ownership. It was much more open because it's hilly. It's like the foothills of the Appalachians. And essentially, the white people couldn't really get all of the Native Americans out. Essentially, the Native Americans like took to the hills and were like genuinely could not get them out. Like they were like formidable.
They're like, no.
And so literally, yeah. So like apparently, I think initially a lot of the white settlers wanted to set the capital of Alabama to be like further upriver, closer to where my family lives. They literally could not do it because the Native Americans were like, you have to like, were like pushed, were like, no. And so that's why the capital's in Montgomery, because Montgomery isn't as hilly. They had to move downriver. They like had to give up basically. And so as a result, that area stayed as a much more like preserved area for like Black land ownership and just like land ownership by non-white people. And that was huge because my family ended up being able to own land, which is, if you're thinking about the history of like wealth in America and all these different standards, my family, you know, they did not grow up, they didn't have money by any means, but they did have land. They had, you know, they could have a farm. They could have a house on their land that was their land.
And they were able to keep possession of it too. I just read Happy Land recently, which is like really talks about how a lot of it got taken back in that area, which would be worth so much. Now, the number she dropped in the acknowledgments is like $350 million or something.
It's literally, and I think my family figured out both sides of my family, because my grandfather, the book is about my grandmother's side. My grandfather's side is also from the same town. And so they somehow, they figured out how to hold on to it. Basically, they held on to their land. They were able to keep it going. Famously, they were not playing about holding on to it. I will say that my great grandfather on my grandfather's side famously had a rifle for every kid and he had 16 children. So they weren't playing. No. Like people did try,
I'm sure,
but like they also learned not to try them. It's basically, it was like a combination. My mom and I are having this conversation actually yesterday about my great grandfather who he died when I was a baby. And he was like a man that truly was no one messed with. Like everyone knew that like Zeke Crosby was like kind of on one, and like you did not mess with Zeke Crosby for any reason. Like he had 16 children and he would fight you. And so he was like known for that. And that was a lot of how the land stayed. In the family was that like a lot of people would try to roll up and they were like, oh, we actually can't mess with them. Like they are too formidable. We have to.
I was just talking to someone about that, how the idea that people love to be like, violence is not the answer. And it's like, if you're being oppressed or someone is trying to oppress you again, violence is the only way out. And I'm not saying he was, I don't know what he did, but I'm like, that's the only way out.
He really understood that concept and took it to heart. Good. Is what I would say for him.
Good for him.
And his stories. Like he was like, I have a house. I have my 16 children. This is my land. These are my cows. This is my situation. You will not be coming on my property. And, you know, and trespassing, they really don't play about trespassing in the South. So historically ever. But that made a huge difference, I think, for my family in general. It really just changed things. And I often then reflect on it for myself, where I think about where I am now. And my mother, you know, my side of my family has been able to get to, you know, I obviously am here. I'm an author. I've been able to go become this like educated, you know, woman in a way that would not have ever been possible. My mother is a PhD. My grandmother was even able. My grandmother was like the first in her family to go to college. Like we all ended up on this sort of chain of progress in this way that I don't think would have been possible without my grandmother Jane's initial sacrifice and choice. Like I just think that we all ended up with much more stability in a lot of ways as Black women from this area.
Yes.
Because she made this decision. Like, if she had not run off that plantation and done what she'd done, like, I don't know that my grandmother would have ended up getting a college degree. Wow. I don't know what would have happened to all of these different people in my family over the course of, you know, rolling time. It is crazy thing, because my initial ancestor, she herself, you know, original Grandma Jane, was not literate. Mm-hmm. That is something I 100% just added into the book. She was not literate. She was never literate, I don't think. The census data that I came across always had her marked as being illiterate. So I don't think she ever, I don't know that she ever learned how to read, but, like, eventually people did. And, like, those are the things that I think I reflect on a lot. And that was part of why I wanted to write this book, was it just made me really think about, you know, oh my gosh, like, this that one ripple. Person in my bloodlines. Yeah, like, this huge sacrifice that she made, and how much, you know, or just this massive risk that she took, and how much that paid off for her descendants. That was really why I was, you know, thinking of doing this.
That makes it, I was looking at your dedication earlier too, and it says, to my grandmother who told me this story and made me believe I could tell it too. And I was like, oh, I hadn't seen it since I read it the first time. And I was like, oh, that just, like, now knowing so much more, it makes it so much more powerful. But another thing that ends up standing out to me in these situations is, like, what you're saying, like, you, this is not far into your family history. And this is another story that is, like, reminding me of that. Cause obviously there's a push by the administration. There's a push by lots of white people who, maybe not even just white people, who are like, it was so long ago, get over it. Like, or it wasn't
and
that
it's ridiculous.
Bad. Is a new one that's coming back?
Yeah, the it wasn't that bad is, like, I think the most shock. My favorite one that's come out recently is, like, slaves learned good skills.
Yeah,
like they're like, oh, but they learned skills. I'm like, okay. Yeah. But again, I often get that. Like, I feel like I've gotten that one on so many different accounts when you hear about when people want to say, oh, this thing was so long ago. Like, my grandparents passed away pretty young, like, relatively on the younger, they passed away both in their 70s and a few years back, back in 2021. But my grandparents were born, you know, these are my grandparents who I was extremely close with, who I grew up with. My grandparents grew up through Jim Crow Alabama.
Yes.
Like, my grandparents, like, this is what I'm often trying, I think people are not understanding when they're like, oh, this was a long time ago. I'm like, my grandparents were adults when they desegregated Alabama. Yeah. They were full-blown adults with children when they desegregated Alabama. Like, my mother is, like, I think maybe one of the first people. My mom wasn't born in Alabama. My mother was born, like, very, very not long after the desegregation of much of the South, or, like, the integration of the South. I think my aunt may have actually been born. Yeah, my aunt, I think, was born when it was still segregated.
These are 1964 was not that long ago.
This is one generation. I'm like, I'm not talking about a long, like, this is one singular generation back. My grandparents, you know, it's like, my grandparents could tell me stories about, like, oh yeah, all of my relatives who were driving in carpools to get around the bus boycotts,
right?
Like, you know, who were all kinds, you know, my grandmother went to Tuskegee and, like, was, I mean, my grandmother had famous stories about the time that she, like, cooked for Martin Luther King because he was staying at the school, because that's what, like, these are not far back. Like, this is not far back. And then, so similarly, I think then when you chart back to, you know, these, my ancestors who were enslaved, or all of these different times, it's like, it wasn't that long ago in the grand scheme of history. We're talking, you know, 100, you know, less than 200 years. There are innumerable things that don't, you know, that's not that long.
Not at all. What's been really confusing to me lately is it seems like there are a lot of white people who have gotten on board with and understand generational trauma in the sense of them going to therapy and being like, oh, this stuff from my grandparents affected my mom and my mom affected me. And, like, they can grasp the concept and then they're like,
yeah, but
just get over it. I'm like, are you kidding me?
It's like, how could we possibly, when we are all still, like, people who are the descendants of slavery are still reckoning with the fallout of that. Like, that is a harm that has absolutely never been repaired in this country. Like, it has never been repaired. Reconstruction, the initial aim was to repair it, and then Reconstruction, they just gave up on that. And so then it just went, you know, there's never been anything there. There's never been any harm change really in a considerable way until you get to like maybe the 1960s. And so again, as a result, there's not, you know, it's like, what's there to get over?
Yeah.
Like what are, or it's like, how could possibly we be moving in that direction when there's never been anything to even repair it? And in many ways, it's like, I think Black Americans have attempted to just kind of pick it up and keep it moving, because what else are you going to do?
Surviving somehow. And
you got to pick it up and keep it moving. Yeah. And I think, you know, it is really, really, it's been really interesting, I think, for me. You know, you write a book, you don't know what the circumstances of the world are going to be like when your book comes out. You write this thing. You know, I wrote this thing all as long ago as I did. And then all of a sudden it's like, here's your pub date. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is what the world's going to be. I'm finding out. And so, you know, it's been very interesting, I think, to be of someone who wrote, I wrote a book about this at the same exact moment that they're going into the museums and saying, we don't need exhibits on slavery anymore. Like, I want the, you know, let's make the museums happier and get rid of all that sad.
Let's not traumatize kids in school by telling our history. Like, okay.
Yeah, I don't think kids should know about this. And you're like, what? And so
we already know too little, because that's been like a huge part of my journey. I mean, for 10 years is like when I was like 19 and could like pick. I grew up in a really controlled Christian evangelical environment, so I didn't get to pick my media. I remember coming to college and being like 19 and watching Mad Men. This is like the weird story I have, but watching Mad Men, and it touched on the civil rights movement because it takes place in the 60s and the 70s. And I was like, wait, it was,
yeah, you were like,
these,
what?
This was the, my dad was born in 1964. Like, what are you talking about? And so even like the education I'd had made it seem like it was so long ago. And I think a lot of people do not understand that like slavery ended however many
1865. So,
and they don't realize that Jim Crow and the attitude of Jim Crow was from then until 1964. Like, I think a lot of people don't even know yet.
And it persevered, frankly.
The racist didn't leave and die because the law
happened. They didn't go anywhere. Yeah. No, they frankly, it morphed and changed. And I think, yeah, exactly. It's like my dad was born in 1953. Mm-hmm. My mom is born, you know, like my mom's born in the 60s. Mm-hmm. My grandparents were in the 40s. Like, we're not looking at a whole bunch of like, you know, my every member of my family, all of my grandparents, all of these people, it's like they all had very, you know, specific experiences with the Jim Crow South in different ways. My dad's side of the family's different. My grandfather on my dad's side was a very famous jazz singer. He was kind of like the Black Frank Sinatra is the best comparison I can give. His name was Billy Eckstine. And he similarly had I didn't really know him. He died when I was little, but he had all kinds of experiences. He wasn't from the South, but he would, of course, tour the South. And it was always the situation where, you know, he was this big celebrity in many ways, but he had to go through all these insane, harrowing experiences touring the South. And also beyond that, leaving the South and getting into opportunities, a lot of his opportunities that he landed were because he was actually very good friends with Frank Sinatra.
Oh, wow.
And Frank Sinatra would basically, like, set him up with gigs. Like, say Frank Sinatra would basically get a gig and then would essentially play like two nights of it and then bail and be like, I'm gonna have Billy do my back do the rest of my gigs. Like, this was very much a thing. And my grandmother, Frank Sinatra was pretty cool, actually. He was pretty legit. And then my grandmother, on that side, similarly, she grew up in like deep Georgia in full Jim Crow. And she pretty much like ran out of Georgia because of all the various like terror and horror that she witnessed in Georgia. And she literally left and like never went back. Like, she was like, that's a wrap. She went to Harlem and was like, that was like an end of the world for her. And you know, these are, again, these are my grandparents. Right. We're not really pushing back here. You know, I'm not going back that far. So I think it is really helpful, I think, for people to have to sit with and like, just be aware of the fact that like, this is not a far back history. It's really not far. And it still has real implications. And frankly, the main person who's at the center of saying that all this stuff is far back and there's no point in reflecting on it was born during it. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, it's like if you're, you know, if you're 79 years old, you were alive for all yes. of this. Yeah. So it's
yeah, that's what's yeah, been wild for me wild. Is I had an experience. I had a couple experiences of learning that some of the people in my life held some beliefs that I was surprised by, and where I'm headed with that mm-hmm. is when all of that was kind of when it was like, we're going to take it out of museums, we're going to do whatever. I had a couple of people like, I just don't believe in systemic racism, and I'm like tired of it like being forced on me. I'm not a racist. And I'm like, those two things don't have to both exist. Like, you can learn about it, you can also not be a racist. And so I've been like just trying to learn more and more so that I can have better conversations when I am met yeah. with that. And it was interesting when you said your grandmother left. I'm reading Cast by Isabel Wilkerson right now. And yeah. it was fascinating because I read Junie, I think in July. So it's been a little bit. And then mm-hmm. I just happened to be reading this when you reached out. But I was just in that chapter that it's talking about how much they needed it to be that like no upper caste people, which is typically people who could seem white or were white, they had to like mm-hmm. make the way that they could make it work across the board was they were pushing so hard to make sure that they never had one-on-one relationships with a Black or any non-white person, because they knew that once you have that one-on-one relationship, you're not thinking of them as like a whole race of people that are terrible. So then that chapter was talking yeah. about that's why we get pools segregated and white people who think that like if they're in the same water, they're going to like die or become diseased.
Catch a disease.
yeah.
Exactly, because they realized very soon that, yeah, exactly, if you spent any time meaningfully mm-hmm. with people in that sort of way, you were going to develop an understanding that, yeah, exactly, this is not a lower caste of people. You're like, oh, they're legitimately just people. Like me. What yeah. am I doing? And, you know, there was a lot of cognitive dissonance in the South right. regardless. Like, you certainly see things that I think Violet being a very good example of, where you can have people who are simultaneously able to sort of reckon with, like, this is a full person who's my friend, but also I get to be in a power mm-hmm. position in this mm-hmm. situation. And there are all kinds of dynamics that were really, you know, wild mm-hmm. that people don't think of in the South of, you know, it was very common for like white children and Black children to be allowed to play together, but they were come to a point where they weren't mm-hmm. allowed to anymore. It wasn't like, it was kind of arbitrary. It just sort of was like, oh, mm-hmm. no more. Like, we're done. And similarly, yeah, the public pools. One of my favorite facts about Alabama is that Alabama was told during integration, they were like, hey, you got to integrate the pools. So Alabama filled in every single public pool in the state.
I remember.
So Alabama has no public pools.
Like, petty cruelty. Like, just.
Yeah. And Alabama has no public pools
still.
Because literally. To this day, Alabama has no public pools because they filled them all in with concrete when they got told to integrate them. So that's like the fun fact of Alabama. And you see this across a bunch of things. You start to notice that throughout the South, there aren't a lot of mm-hmm. parks. There aren't a lot of public open spaces yeah. like that. And it's because, again, these were all spaces that they were forced to integrate. They would have been forced yes. to integrate. And essentially, when it came time to do that, a lot of these states basically just decided to close public spaces or make public areas inaccessible because they were like, we don't want to do it. So we're going to instead of having, you know, park where everybody can go, no one gets a park. Oh it was a lot of that. It was like, so nobody crazy. Can go to the park. Or you can go to the country club and that's your park.
Right.
And so if you can get into that, then you're good. But you can't, there, you know, public spaces were really, you know, that's why if you go to the South, you know, it's like here in New York, I can walk to, you know, Prospect yeah. Park, I can go to Central Park, whatever. You're going to see all mm-hmm. kinds of people. You don't have that in so much of this country because literally that's why.
That's reminding me yeah. when I loved Sinners and I did an episode about it.
Oh, so yes. good.
Loved so good. Too. I did an episode actually with one of my friends who, when you were talking, she's like such a big example to me that I sometimes use with people who are like, it's not in the system, where like her dad is one of the Little Rock Nine and was like the first senior to graduate in Little Rock.
Wow.
In a non-segregated school. So it's like, that's her dad. We're not even talking yeah. about grandpa. That's her dad.
That's right there. Like Ruby Bridges. That's yes, exactly. Ruby Bridges was like, oh, it's supposed to be old. I'm like, Ruby Bridges is not that old.
I know.
I'm like, Ruby Bridges is not that old. Like, what are we talking about? Yeah, I know. Anyway, continue.
But yeah, we did an episode about Sinners, and she, it was really cool. I mean, cool to have her be a part of it because she actually has Native American, Chinese or Asian, and Black ancestry. So like that book did, like, or the, that movie dealt with all of that. Anyway, we were talking about, at one point, about how the movie even shows how racism hurts white people too, and they don't think so. So like that scene when the Native Americans try to like warn them that like, hey, this thing is coming, like you better not interact with it. The dude's already in their house and they're like, leave, leave. Like they don't want to hear the message just because he's not white, and they cast him out. And they end up getting bitten by a vampire, essentially. So it's like, and they even got hurt. And that pool thing is making me think of that, or the public spaces. Like, one, it means everyone lost access to pools, but not being able to be in community with more kinds of people is hurtful, whether white people want to recognize it or not.
Yeah, it ends up being harmful, and it ends up being bad regardless. Yeah, it's like systemic racism is bad bad for everyone. No one is benefiting, really, other than like, I think, extremely wealthy people.
Yeah, wealthy people.
Yeah, other than like literally oligarchs. Like literally oligarchs.
Greed does well. Other than that, basically.
Yeah, it's good. It's good for like, yeah, hardcore class issues. But I think
And in keeping people fighting with each other instead of like,
yeah, it's good for that. But it's not, it doesn't benefit anyone. No one's doing better as a result of it. And I think, you know, there are a lot of examples of that. I think that even when you're thinking about the way in which a lot of, you know, programs in this country are heavily racialized, when in the reality, like, these are programs that help everybody. I think something, you know, we're looking at the currently with like SNAP benefits,
and the AI,
really good example, where I think that, yeah, and the amount that they're doing, I think that there's a lot of pushes to make it seem like SNAP benefits are this like racialized issue, that only certain people are using SNAP benefits, and therefore it's totally fine to not have them. When the reality is that, like,
are white.
Yeah. Yes. One, statistically, that's the case. And then two, everyone benefits from this thing. It's like, we're all benefiting from these different programs. And it's like this type of systemic racism and these types of emphasis on it in that way, it doesn't, it harms everyone. Does.
That's what I feel like I've come.
It ends up backhandedly harming
so
everyone.
Much more aware of is like, as I've learned more about Indigenous culture, and as well, just the wide range of what it has meant to be Black in America as well. I'm like, we've missed out on like cultures that actually practice community in a way that like takes care of each other, cares about the land, thinks about the future. Like we've lost out on like more empathetic overall cultures. That's how it's started to make me feel. But the other thing that I think is so cool about Junie, to bring it back to that, is as I'm almost done with Cast. I've been listening to it the last couple of weeks, and as I was listening to it and like thinking about my questions for you, I was like, this is one of my favorite things with books. Like the accessibility to empathy for a character that like, maybe you would never talk to someone like that. Maybe you just don't even know what happened in history. But that chapter where she was saying like, they were so set on making sure white people didn't emotionally connect one-on-one, because it would make the person an actual person. I feel like that is what happens with Junie, is we connect so much to her that you're like, I know there are sociopaths who could read it and not care. But I think in general, if you're reading this, how could you not find some more empathy for that situation and like maybe believe that history was a little bit rough? So I do love how it creates the one-on-one relationship in a book form.
Yeah. And I definitely really appreciate that. And I think, you know, that's what's really amazing, I think, about fiction, historical fiction specifically, is that it is a means of helping us to build a sense of empathy and connection to people that we otherwise couldn't because of time. And I think, you know, you end up, I think, learning a lot more and feeling a lot more because you feel this emotional connection to what's going on. And that is a lot of what I hoped to achieve with Junie writing it. It was like, I wanted people to be able to develop this different relationship to history via a connection with a person, because that's really what people connect to. We connect to each other. We connect to each other's stories more than we connect to like facts and statistics and all of that information. It's like, you're only going to get so far with that. I think a lot of times people need to feel like there's like a character mm-hmm. or something that's going to really resonate with them on that different way to really feel something and feel yes. connected.
Well, obviously I loved it. Everyone needs to go read it or listen to it, however you want to go about that. I do always ask, and I know you have lots of recommendations. I always ask if there are books that mm-hmm. like you would always recommend or anything you've read recently that you really loved.
Sure. I think so many that would be like, what's the last thing I read that I was like, I absolutely like loved that. I'm trying to think of my last really good. I'll go to other picks that are like books that are in the Juni universe that I think are like the things that inspired yeah. me with this book, which would be, I think Jesmyn Wordsing Unburied Sing is always a really big one. I love that book. And I think that that's something that if you enjoy Juni, you should definitely go read. It was definitely an inspiration for yeah. me. It's like another sort of like Southern Gothic ghost mm-hmm. story situation. I was really inspired by Kindred for this book. Mm-hmm. And I think if you haven't read Octavia Butler's Kindred, like gotta go do that.
That's up next for me. I have fallen in love with her. It's so good. That one's the next one for
it's
me.
It's so Kindred and is
it's
so
like
good.
Sci-fi-ish. I was like, damn. Mm-hmm.
It is. It's really good. And then I'm currently listening to Wuthering Heights. Like I'm reading Wuthering Heights for what's maybe like the third yeah. time. Just because like it's just really melodramatic it and it hits. Like it's just a great time. It's great for fall. Mm-hmm. It's like a classic that really holds up. It's just I love it and I needed to go back and just do Wuthering Heights again. So I'm currently listening to that. And then I'm trying to think of like some of the newer books that really I'm like cataloging what I've read mm-hmm. recently in my brain. I read The Hacienda pretty mm-hmm. recently and I did really mm-hmm. like that. I thought that too. Was like a really fun, good, like solid gothic-y yeah. ghost story situation. Like I think it had a good the ghost vibes yes. were strong. And it did, I think in general I generally liked it. My favorite one to constantly recommend in the sort of like ghosty creepy genre right now that I've read is Our Share of Night by Mariana Enriquez. Okay. Love that book. It's like floating around on my shelf. I'm like always talking about it. It's like genuinely horror. Like it is 100% okay. horror, but it's so good. It's basically it's so good. It's set during the like Argentine dictatorship okay. Of like the 20th century. And basically again, I think it's a really good example of like characters to help you access yes. historical period. But the general gist is that it's about like it starts off as being a father and son where the mother has just died tragically. And the father is bringing the son to the maternal grandparents who just so happen to be the heads of a satanic cult. And so like they are the heads of this like insane satanic, like capitalist rich Ooh. People cult where they're essentially like doing insane stuff in the pursuit of like power mm. and wealth and all of these different things. And it becomes this very like panoramic okay. story that goes across like different time periods and all these things. It's got a lot of like Stephen King-y kind of references. Yeah. It's very haunted, very creepy, very messed mm-hmm. up. Like just deeply, I really worry for what's going on in the head. Like I finished that book and I was like, I don't know if Mariana Enriquez is okay, but like whatever's wrong with her, I do really like it yes. in this case. Like this, she has used what's wrong and has made it just really yes. hit as a book. It's so good. I talk about it all the time because it was just like life alteringly yeah. great. So I highly, highly recommend that. If you need something where you're like, I want to read something that is going to make me think deeply about like relationships and history and power and capitalism, but is also going to be like messed up, like really leading with yes. that.
Okay. One. This one, so it started to show up on mine because October was like Latinx, Latin America, History Month.
Heritage Month, yeah.
So I had been seeing it everywhere. And so when you first said it, it was one where like I haven't completely remembered it, where I didn't know the cover when you said it. Mm-hmm. And then I looked it up. I was like, oh, this is on my TBR. So I'm going to be bumping that one up.
It is it's long. Like you have to, it is like a 500 pager. So you have to just sort of like buckle up, but it's like highly worth the buckle up. And it's also like, it's told in sort of like five different segments. Yeah. So it almost feels like you're reading like chunked up stories in that way. I loved it. It's so good. Just 10 out of 10.
I'm going to bump that one up. Definitely. Where can everyone follow you to stay up to date?
Sure. So I'm just Erin Crosby Eckstein everywhere that I have a thing. So I'm mostly I'm currently on like a kind of a social media hiatus because I really have to write my second book. And if I have to work on my second book and like I unfortunately am one of the people where like social media and like doing anything else don't mix for me. So you can come find me on I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. I'm there. I might not be posting as much as I used to, but you can find me. So yes, if you just look my name up, I will
appear. You will.
You look my name up and you'll find me. Her.
Yes. Well, I'll also put the link in the show notes. And I can't wait to see what you read next or what you write next or read too.
Yes. Yes. I kind of know what I'm writing next, but writing a book is it. That's a whole other conversation.
I'm sure. I can't even imagine. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad we got to talk.